KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Welcome to Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. Libraries and museums are among the latest services that are being cut from the Trump administration's ongoing drive to reduce federal spending. Many tribal libraries and cultural centers are forced to cut hours, reduce staff, trim programs, or even close altogether. On top of that, federal assistance for heating and energy efficiency help for low-income Native Americans is all but eliminated, and Head Start childcare programs are scrambling after nationwide funding cuts. We'll get the latest rundown on how the cuts are affecting people right after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Events are being planned at the California State Capitol in Sacramento to raise awareness of missing and murdered Indigenous people cases. May 5th, on National Missing and Murdered Indigenous People Day, state lawmakers and tribal leaders will deliver remarks at the Capitol Park, and the Capitol Dome will be illuminated red for 2 nights to observe MMIP. Events will continue through the week, including a hearing involving tribal safety, and a candlelight vigil will be held. The Native American Legislative Caucus and its chair, Assemblymember James Ramos, are leading the week-long activities. Ramos is the first and only California Native American currently serving in the state legislature. He spoke at a California Missing and Murdered Indigenous People Summit this winter about tribal advocacy and representation in the legislature to address MMIP.
Being in the state legislature and with all your support, we've been able to start to bring pieces of legislation forward and gaining allies in the state legislature and within law enforcement, gaining allies to bring forward the issue of missing and murdered Indigenous women.
During the week of activities, Ramos will present a resolution on the assembly floor to designate May as Missing and Murdered Indigenous People Awareness Month. Heather Schotten has been appointed the president of Fort Lewis College in Durango, Colorado, becoming the first Native American to hold the position. The Board of Trustees appointed her to the leadership role on Friday. Schotten has more than 20 years of experience in academic leadership and has been part of the college's executive leadership team for the past 3 years. In a statement, she said she's honored to lead Fort Lewis College and is committed to building a future grounded in belonging, access, and academic excellence for students. Schotten is an enrolled citizen of the Wichita and affiliated tribes and a descendant of the Kiowa and Cheyenne tribes. She's been recognized for advancing cultural responsive practices and policies for Indigenous students. Her work at Fort Lewis College has included reconciliation with faculty and staff, acknowledging the institution's history as a federal Indian boarding school. She officially assumes the presidency on July 1st. AMC's acclaimed series, Dark Winds, has tackled various heavy issues, which now includes clergy sexual abuse in its latest episode. Brian Bull has more.
In the episode titled, What He Had Been Told, Navajo Police Lieutenant Joe Leaphorn has a series of visions and flashbacks while pursuing a mysterious figure through the wilderness. One involves a priest taking a young relative into an isolated space to do the unthinkable. Actor Zahn McLarnon plays Leaphorn.
There's a lot of things I could relate to in that scene. I went through some things as a kid. I'm not going to get into details, but they're very similar to, how Joe was affected when he was a kid. You know, I think as human beings, you know, we go through these painful experiences, these loss, this tragedy, joy. As an actor, all I do is I try to lean into that.
McLarnon says the episode's director, Erica Tremblay, put a lot of thought and sensitivity before shooting the specific scene.
Erica made a very, very safe environment, along with the other producers, Tina Elmo on the show, and Jim Chori and John Worth, made a very, very safe environment for not just me, but for the kids in the scene. It was a closed set, so people weren't allowed on the set. It was just the directors and the actors and the cameramen.
In recent years, accounts of physical, emotional, and sexual abuse against Native children have come out in both government-run and church-run boarding schools. Last year, President Joe Biden formally apologized on behalf of the United States for atrocities committed against government boarding school students. AMC's Dark Winds is on Sunday nights. It's been renewed for a fourth season. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Scoot Dash. For more than 40 years, Ramona Farms has revived ancient traditional foods. Tepary beans, pinoli, polentas, and more, all from store.ramonafarms.com. Ramona Farms supports this show. Om Yen. Support by the Gathering of Nations Powwow, a live event taking place April 24th, 25th, and 26th at the Expo New Mexico, featuring song and dance, Trader's Market, Horse Parade, Stage 49, and more. Tickets at gatheringofnations.com and at the gates. Support by Siri, with a diverse and strategic investment portfolio for the long-term benefit of their shareholders. Investing in energy, infrastructure, real estate, government services, and more. Information is available at CIRI.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. A tribal library in New Mexico says it will have to close after the Trump administration abruptly canceled federal grants administered through the Institute for Museum and Library Services. It is among dozens of tribal libraries, museums, and cultural centers that must cut hours, eliminate staff, cancel cultural and language programs, and halt new book purchases. Their grants were rescinded. Meanwhile, other funding cuts will pull financial help for low-income residents to pay their heating bills in the winter. And the early childhood education program Head Start, that serves almost 30,000 Native children, is in limbo as its entire administrative staff was eliminated. These are among the latest changes as the Trump administration works to redesign the federal government. How are federal cuts affecting your community? Are you concerned? Or do you think there is room to lower federal costs that fund Native programs and services? Join us by calling 1-800-996-2848. We value all perspectives and opinions. 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Let's now meet our first guest. Joining us from Santa Fe, New Mexico, is Cassandra Osterloh. She is the New Mexico State Library Tribal Libraries Program Coordinator, and she's a citizen of the Cherokee Nation. Cassandra, hello, and welcome to Native America Calling.
Thank you, Sean.
It's great to have you. I got to let you know, I spoke with a librarian at the Pueblo of Laguna this morning, and I was very relieved to learn that our tribal library has not been significantly impacted by federal cuts up to this point. But what can you tell us about other tribal libraries in the state of New Mexico?
So, in New Mexico, we have 23 tribal public libraries, and right now there are eight grants, federal grants that have been awarded to those libraries for the fiscal year that have all been terminated as of last week.
So. And what does this mean for tribal citizens who actually use those libraries maybe every day?
So this means that there are going to be, as you mentioned, there are going to be some cuts in hours for some of those libraries. Some of the programs, such as after-school programming or summer programming, are going to be either lessened or eliminated completely. And then many of the materials that maybe that they the libraries were going to purchase, such as books and computers and other devices to check out, they won't be able to get those into the libraries and into the hands of the community members.
What are you hearing in terms of alternative funding? Are there other options available to make up for these shortfalls?
Right now, we're not seeing many, if any at all. I think the concern is that there are so many cuts to many of these federal programs that anything that might be out there that are private or, let's say, non-federal programs are going to be inundated with requests. And at this point, we're not really finding any that are going to be relevant to the libraries and the needs and the requirements that they are losing, you know, from the grants that they did have, such as staffing, salaries, and wages.
Tell us more about these libraries. What types of services do they offer? And what do folks do when they visit these libraries?
So a lot of the tribal libraries provide support for their entire communities, their elder centers, often their schools and early childhood education programs. They're educational and cultural hubs. There's a lot of programming that happens at these libraries that are traditional or cultural programs, multi-generational programs, things like drum making or creating traditional regalia or beading. There's language classes, traditional storytelling. Oftentimes there's story times for the children in the native language in the of the tribe. So there's, you know, there are those programs, but there's also the access to materials that maybe might assist community members in things like creating regalia that they may not have at home, like sewing machines or sergers or looms, or even the gardening components where they can go to the library and check out gardening tools. So there are a lot of different programs as well as materials that the libraries provide that is just more than maybe a book on the shelf. You know, there's a place that that kids can go after school. There are they've integrated, you know, native language and language instruction throughout the library services, and a lot of the libraries are collaborating with elder centers or Head Starts to do these programs as well within the classes or the centers. You know, aside from just being in the library or after school or on the weekends.
How about computer and internet access? Do libraries also serve as technology hubs in some of these tribal communities?
They do, and that's a very good point. There's a lot of people who need to go into the library to use a computer, to use a printer, to access something online, such as applying for a job or working, you know, through their online classes. Many schools, if the school is closed for the day here in New Mexico, a lot of the schools have gone to online learning for instead of a snow day. And so many students need to access the library and their computers in order to go to school too.
Cassandra, how dire is this situation then for these libraries that are significantly impacted in New Mexico? I mean, is there a possibility at some point maybe they could even close?
I think for a handful, that could be the case. That, you know, we're looking at possible layoffs for one or two of the libraries of their staff, which then in turn means, you know, who's going to run that library. So the next step could be that the library does close. For some of the other libraries, it's more of a reduction in hours. So not being able to have evening or weekend hours, which makes it difficult, right? If you're at school or work, to be able to go to the library if the library is open when you're at school or work and not available during those weekend or evening hours.
Cassandra, how far back do these libraries go in our communities? Have some of them been open for decades, maybe even generations?
Yes, there are a handful of our tribal libraries who've been open since the 50s or 60s. So, you know, they're an important component of their communities. There's a couple of others that are brand new that we're working really hard to get things going with. And for them, this is where the funding is starting for their community to get this library going, and has a more negative impact, I think, than maybe a library that's been there for a little bit longer.
Now, we have many listeners all over the country. Some of them live in tribal communities. Some of them live in urban areas. Can you explain the difference between how a tribal library, like the ones we're talking about with you, as opposed to maybe an urban library in a city or a town somewhere, how they get funded and what that extra challenge might be for a tribal library?
Sure. So the non-tribal libraries tend to get the majority of their funding through municipal or local taxes, so the city taxes or even maybe county taxes. We don't see that in the tribal public libraries. You know, there's funding allocated through the tribe. The tribal libraries will also, if where applicable, get some state funding and then apply for federal grants. The non-tribal libraries, like I said, the largest percentage are coming from their local taxes. They also, we're going to have maybe a friends group that can do fundraising for them. And we don't see that as often with the tribal libraries.
What are you hearing from tribal library coordinators in other states outside of New Mexico?
It's a similar situation throughout the country. There are libraries that are going to have to close. There are libraries that are losing staff or hours or programs and materials that, you know, that their communities have become dependent upon and are needing.
Cassandra, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, thanks. I thought I lost you maybe just for a moment there. You know what's interesting about tribal libraries, I've learned, is some of them are very small. There might just be one staffer. Some of them have larger staff groups. But I'm curious, maybe just give us a brief rundown of like what a typical tribal library that you work with, how many employees they have, and like what's a typical annual budget for them?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't know what a typical annual budget might be for them, but I could tell you that the majority of the libraries, at least in New Mexico, there's one main staff person, and then you might be able to have a secondary, maybe part-time person, if you're able to get some extra or outside funds. There, like you said, there are a few that are larger that have multiple staff members, but they really do tend to be what we call solo librarians, so the only person in the building and working and doing all of this work by themselves. So if they're able to get extra funds through grants, workforce development programs, then they try to hire somebody, and it tends to be more on a part-time basis.
All right. And one more question before we go to break, but some of these librarians in these tribal libraries in New Mexico, what's foremost on their mind right now? What are their biggest concerns you're hearing?
I think their biggest concerns are just the uncertainty. What is actually happening? How do I access maybe the funds that we were supposed to, you know, that they were told they would have? And if not, then what are we supposed to do next? What are our next steps, and how are we going to go about doing that?
All right. Thank you. Cassandra Osterlo kicking off our conversation here on Native America Calling. We're talking about tribal libraries, museums, and cultural centers impacted by federal cuts through the Trump administration. You'd like to join the conversation. Maybe you work in a tribal library, maybe you work in a museum, or maybe you just like to go visit your tribal library on frequent occasions. Maybe you are a bookworm, or you go there to access the internet, use a computer. Maybe you go there to hang out with your friends and community members. Maybe you go there for meetings and other events, whatever it is. Give us a call. We'd like to hear from you and what your thoughts are with regard to federal grants administered through the Institute for Museum and Library Services that have been abruptly canceled. The number to join us, 1-800-996-2848. Experts say at least half of all U.S. honeybee colonies were lost over the winter months in what could be the worst die-off in history. That troubling news comes as the U.S. is seeing a steady decline in monarch butterflies. They are among insects that pollinate flowers, trees, and many of the crops that feed us. We'll hear from native beekeepers and other experts about ways to save crucial pollinators. That's on the next Native America Calling.
My name is Tammy, and I'm a member of the Little Traverse Bay Band of Odawa Indians. Smoking gave me heart disease. I used to think of cigarette smoking as something that only affected me. Then at just 44 years old, I had to look into my mom's eyes on the way into emergency heart surgery and tell her, "Mommy, I promise I won't make you bury me." My tip is, think about the people in your life who love you. They go through the pain too, maybe even more than you do.
The people you love are worth quitting for. You can quit. For free help, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. A message from the CDC.
Father's plan. Ooh, yes. Ease up, Mr. Bush. You already got Saddam. We don't need no more war down here. With Arafat one, Sharon, what you are going to do? Rise up!
We the people are in a situation, and it's we the people that need us a resolution. What's going on across the nation?
You are tuned to Native America Calling. We're talking about how cuts to federal funding and staff are impacting Native people and tribes. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-996-2848. Are funding and employment where you live in limbo because of Trump's executive orders? Or is it pretty much still business as usual? Give us a call. Let us know. 1-800-99-NATIVE. That's the number to call. 1-800-99-NATIVE. Our next guest, Dr. April Counselor, joins us from Kodiak, Alaska, where she is the executive director of the Aleutic Museum and Archaeological Repository. She is an Aleutic tribal member of the Shunack Tribe of Kodiak. April, good morning, and welcome to Native America Calling.
Chamai, hello. Thanks for having me on today.
It's a pleasure to have you on the show, April. And let's talk about federal grants that your library, your museum recently lost. How does this impact your work, and how big of a portion of federal funding is the museum's operation dependent on?
Well, last week, the museum received three termination notices on our IMLS grants, and two of them were actually for our tribal library that we house in our museum, because we're more than just a traditional museum like many Native culture centers. We also have a research component, an educational outreach component, and a lot of our different categories mix. Our two library grants were related to improving our library services and hours for the public. And we were also working on an art book of contemporary Aleutic arts. And then our museum grant was to help fund exhibits. We've been doing a massive renovation project for the past couple of years, not using federal funds on the construction, but we have had some federal grants to help with the exhibits and the educational materials that we were developing related to the reopening, which is scheduled for May 22nd. Just a little bit over a month away. So the timing has been a little bit devastating for us as we've been trying to wrap up the creation of our new exhibits. We've got a lot of different activities going on and really looking forward to celebrating with our community. We do still plan to reopen. That is a really big goal for us. But the funding situation is definitely a concern, given that just these three grants represent perhaps a third to a quarter of our annual budget.
Were any reasons provided for the funding cuts?
Our termination letters just said that they are enacting the termination clause in our grant agreements, and the grants are no longer consistent with agency priorities. So there were no specific details or information given about why our grants were canceled. But I believe what I've heard is that all of the IMLS grants were canceled.
So if the idea here perhaps is for museums and libraries and some of these other institutions to adjust, reduced funding, they'll have to adjust, serve the community, figure out a way. Is there a way to do that? Can you efficiently do that without this money?
Well, I do think of our organization as kind of a scrappy organization. You know, we're located in rural Alaska. We've always had to be sort of entrepreneurial to be able to keep our doors open and serve our community. But the funding from entities like the Institute for Museum and Library Services have really enabled us to become a larger, more useful organization to our community. And because of the size of our town that we are in, you know, the town of Kodiak, Alaska is a little over 6,000 people. We're on an island. And so the size of our community is not large enough to really support us with just admissions revenue or local donations. We have a pretty big network of supporters around the country, but we also go after national grants because otherwise we would not be able to do the things that we really want to do for our mission to preserve and share our culture.
We heard from our earlier guest talk about some of the reasons that community members might visit a tribal library, but how about the Aleutic Museum? What are some services or programs that people on Kodiak might go there for?
Well, people who are interested in archaeology, we've had a really strong archaeology program at the Aleutic Museum for nearly 30 years. including community archaeology. And so community members can learn about how we understand the past of our human history. If they're not interested in archaeology, we also have a language program where we teach and learn our traditional language, which was very threatened by the end of the 20th century. And we've had a revitalization movement that the museum is very involved in. We also produce cultural resources and curricula, things that the schools can use, that teachers can pick up, such as ed boxes to provide cultural education in their classrooms. And we also have a lot of workshops, like arts workshops, where members of the community and the public can come in and learn how to make a beaded necklace or an aspect of our regalia. We also are involved in local tourism. Cruise ships come to Kodiak, and we are very proud of our local offerings. We have a handful of museums and other community-based organizations that are involved in the tourism as it increases in Alaska. And so we kind of have something for everyone, and we don't only serve the Native community. Of course, that's the core of what we do. We're a Native-run organization, but we as a community are really open to having people from any heritage who are curious about Aleutic Sukpiak history and culture. We want people to come in. We want people to learn about the unique culture of our island home. And we're very happy with the partnerships that we have and the reach that we have. So we are a little bit worried about what's coming down the pike. These kind of feel like potentially our first three terminations rather than our only three that we can expect. There are a number of grants that we're keeping an eye on from other federal agencies, and we're trying to stay connected to the network of information, including communication with our congressional delegation, who have been as helpful as they can in trying to facilitate information sharing and looking for ways to help preserve and restore the funding that we competed for and earned to be able to do these projects for our community.
April, let's talk about the repatriation work that you also do there at the Aleutic Museum. Now, I understand a few years ago you brought back an ancestral kayak. Is that the type of activity, the type of action that's going to be impacted here going forward?
Yes, a lot of times when we know of really important cultural objects in other places where we're able to collaborate with those museums, we've been very fortunate to receive some special objects back to our home region, such as the Peabody kayak that you're referring to that was at the Peabody Museum, and we worked with their museum to have a long-term loan for a number of years, and then they worked with us to convert it into a donation back to the home community. But for me, one of the most important aspects of the repatriation work is the human remains repatriation. There are known dozens of Aleutic Sukpiak human remains in other institutions, you know, museums and universities around the country. And our museum has been involved in the repatriation of hundreds of others who have been removed during archaeological investigations in the early 20th century, brought to museums and universities for study around the country, and through the process of NAGPRA, the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, we're able to work with our local tribal communities. We have 10 tribes on our island to bring those ancestors back home. And for me, that's been an incredibly meaningful part of my career, to bring these ancestors and put them back to rest so that they will not be sitting on a shelf somewhere. And most of our repatriation work that we have completed has been aided by grants, some of them federal, some of them private.
April, thank you for joining the show. I want to talk about another program that's being impacted. This one is south of you in Bozeman, Montana, where we have our third guest on the line, Jill Falcon Raymaker, and she is the director of Buffalo Nation's Food Systems Initiative at Montana State University. She is Turtle Mountain Anishinaabe. Jill, good morning and welcome to the show.
Bonjour, Sean. Bonjour, Ninjinamay Maganadok. I'm happy to join the circle here.
We're happy to have you on the show, Jill. And let's talk about a $5 million grant from the USDA for food sovereignty work that you folks were anticipating. It's part of the funding freeze now. What's going on? What does this mean to you?
Yeah, that grant was a USDA NextGen grant with our partner out in Newtown, North Dakota, Nueda Hadassah Saanich Tribal College. And we do education and research for indigenous tribal food sovereignty. And so that cut programs that were meant to prepare indigenous food systems professionals. We have a chronic shortage of human capacity in indigenous food systems, indigenous food sovereignty. And so this is really about developing curriculum at a tribal college and graduate and undergraduate level at the university to prepare those food systems professionals. But it represents just one of three USDA grants that our program has that have been paused. There are two others, an FSA NEFA grant that was meant to help start an indigenous food laboratory but with North American traditional indigenous food systems out of Minneapolis and Chef Sean Sherman. And that new indigenous foods lab here in Bozeman was to serve the entire region of the Buffalo Nation's food system initiative, the Northern Plains and Rockies. And then a third grant was a Climate Smart grant with our partners from Pekani Lodge Health Institute in Browning, Montana. And that grant really supports or supported regenerative agriculture, really turning to indigenous knowledges of place to support sustainable food systems, just like we have had in this region prior to colonization, a food system that was sustainable for 13,000 years. So these three grants represent a big setback in our work in indigenous food sovereignty in this region.
So how much total money are we talking about? Because the first grant, $5 million, what about the second and third grants? How much total?
In total, we're talking about $17 million.
Have you spent any of that money yet?
Yeah, some of these grants were already underway. So we have staff that have been in place, graduate students, undergraduate students, and we've been working collectively on a broad range of projects, including with community members and in support of indigenous producers. And so this is affecting people throughout the region who have been a part of this network in the footprint of our traditional food system. And so, yeah, it's hurting programs throughout the region.
Now, it's not uncommon for big grants to be paid out in installments. Have you already received a few installments, or did you pay for these programs so far out of your own or out of the organization's own pocket or other funding sources in anticipation of receiving these grants in the future?
Yeah, exactly. So USDA grants, generally, we do the work and then we draw down the money after the work has been done in installments. And one of the big issues has been that portal from USDA has just been paused. And so there's months of pay, salary pay that has been, is not being reimbursed. And for some of our grant partners who are leads on these grants, such as Nueda Hadassah Saanich College, this puts them in a tremendous precarious situation financially, that the federal government is not paying on the contracts that were approved by the U.S. Congress.
What's the likelihood that these grants or this portal will come back online and you'll be able to access this money?
That's something that we just don't know. I mean, there's really little information being shared, and no one to really speak to at USDA that is either there any longer or has more information than we do. So there's a lot of uncertainty. We're doing our best to move people to the bit of limited private funding that we have, but every partner in our programs, they're dealing with it in the best way that they can. And it has resulted in layoffs, and it has resulted in the shutdown of various programs.
Jill, did you and your partner see this coming, or were you completely blindsided?
I think that once the election happened, we were all very concerned. But the rapidity of how this happened, the lawlessness, the how quickly it happened, and that it when it did happen, it was effective today, and that we needed to begin to cover payroll effective immediately on other sources, that was shocking. And I think that along with all the other policies that are changing in the world right now, this is very disorienting. It felt like we were just getting started in Indigenous food sovereignty, really building back our food systems in significant ways after 150 years of, you know, the eradication of the buffalo, the replacement foods that have come our way that have been very unhealthy. And we had some very significant leadership in USDA that was so helpful to moving these programs forward, such as Zach Ducheneau over in the Farm Service Agency and Heather Dawn Thompson, Director of Office of Tribal Relations, both members of the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe. And they had moved some really significant programs forward, like the USDA Indigenous Food Sovereignty Initiative and regenerative ag programs and local food purchasing assistance. And all of those programs represented significant momentum as Native nations are taking possession of their health, and not only their health, the health of their children, the health of the land. So this does represent a setback in a major reset that was very necessary for our food system.
Jill Falcon Raymaker joining the conversation from Bozeman, Montana, where she is the director of Buffalo Nation's Food Systems Initiative, and that is at Montana State University. So we've had three guests on the show so far, and we've got two more waiting in the wings on the other side of this break. So we're going to continue this conversation, and I encourage for listeners to join us as well. You can do that by calling 1-800-996-2848. We'd really like to get some perspectives from folks living in the community in terms of what you feel about how these programs and these services, these institutions could be impacted by federal cuts. Just give us a call, 1-800-99-NATIVE. And of course, you can always interact with us on social media as well, Facebook, Instagram, Blue Sky Threads. We have all of those platforms available for our listeners to engage with us, or just go to our website, www.nativeamericacalling.com. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Trickster Cultural Center, an authentic first voice of Native American veterans and cultural arts, will host the 2025 Summer Youth Powwow to foster community relations, youth literacy, cultural exchange, and provide local community resources. Trickster Cultural Center's Summer Youth Powwow is open to the public at no charge and takes place May 31st in Schaumburg, Illinois. More at TricksterCulturalCenter.org/summer-youth-powwow-2025. Trickster Cultural Center supports this show. Did you know that one person can save up to 8 lives and heal dozens more through the gift of organ and tissue donation? Give hope to thousands of people across the U.S. waiting for a life-saving organ transplant. Learn more about the power of organ, eye, and tissue donation with Life Center Northwest, the organ procurement organization serving all of Alaska, at lcnw.org. That's lcnw.org. Are you or someone you care about looking to take their education to the next level? Native Forward Scholars Fund is here to help. With awards up to $30,000, Native Forward Scholars Fund is dedicated to supporting Native students as they pursue higher education. With Native Forward Scholarships, you can overcome financial barriers and open doors to a world of opportunities. Native Forward Scholars Fund, working to build a brighter future and empower Native students one scholarship at a time. Info and applications at nativeforward.org, who support this show. Support provided by Alaska Growth Capital. The North Slope Marketplace is now open. Arctic Slope Regional Corporation shareholders and descendants are eligible. Applications are available at alaskagrowth.com under Marketplace.
Support for law and justice-related programming provided by Hobbs, Strauss, Dean & Walker, LLP, a national law firm dedicated to promoting and defending tribal rights for over 40 years. More information available at HobbsStrauss.com.
You are listening to Native America Calling. We're talking about federal programs on the chopping block by the Trump administration. What changes is your tribe making because of recent executive actions? Are there alternatives to federal funding? Tell us about it. We're at 1-800-996-2848. That number again, 1-800-996-2848. And we have the phone lines open. Let's now go to Bellingham, Washington, where we have our next guest on the line, Alicia Allard. She is a tribal Head Start consultant and a specialist for Little Hawk Consulting. Alicia, you've been on the show before. Welcome back. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm happy to be here for this conversation. It's unfortunately very timely, and there's a lot of intersections between what all of the other guests are going through and what the Head Start program traditionally provides, what the services are set up to provide for children and families and all of our communities, and all of the impacts that these cuts are having. They don't happen just in these silos. They have this ripple effect through all of the services in the community. So this is it's really great that you guys are having this group conversation with all of these programs.
Yeah, you bet. Alicia, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we're going to work on your phone line for just a moment. So just hang tight. We'll have a producer work with you. And I want to bring another guest into the conversation now. Joining us from Isleta Pueblo, we have Andrea Piscina. She is the executive director of the Isleta Head Start and Child Care Program and the president of the National Indian Head Start Directors Association. She's also a tribal citizen of Isleta Pueblo. Andrea, hello and welcome to the show.
Hello, everyone.
Andrea, tell us about Head Start there at the Pueblo of Isleta. How's it being impacted by funding cuts at the national level?
So right now, as far as our program at the Head Start here in Isleta, it has not been impacted, but there is rumors and things that are going on at the federal level where they're already seeing impacts of it. So I know federally, some of our partners that we work with on the federal level and the federal office have been affected. And it's not like small effects, it's bigger regional effects. And so that kind of will eventually trickle down to kind of what we're going to see at the program level as far as the support we're getting from the federal level. And the as it trickles down, as we're working with our federal partners in different offices of how they are supporting us as programs, especially in our tribal programs, it could delay some of the funding to our Head Start centers because they're the ones that sign off on our grants. It could even close, do temporary closures if our fiscal people aren't able to approve any our grants in a timely manner. So there's a variety of impacts that haven't hit us directly, but it's us, like all the others said prior, not operating on not knowing the unknown.
Andrea, listening to the other guests today talk about how their programs have been impacted, you shared that nothing at this point, you're hearing rumors, you've got some thoughts about what might be coming down the line. What types of preparations are you making in the event that you could see significant cuts in the near future?
We're working with our tribal leaders to kind of figure out what does that look like for our community. Is it that we have to notify parents and close our doors? Is it that there's other program, like for us, we operate our Head Start program along with our CCDF program, and we're all under one roof. And so is it that CCDF has to supplement Head Start, vice versa? Just kind of looking at what would it look like in the event that we do lose funding, and where does that come from, and what supports do we have in order to keep the services open for our community and the children and families that would be affected. Because ultimately, at the end of the day, that is who is going to be affected, is our children, families, and our staff.
Right. Let's talk more about those children and families there at Isleta Pueblo, in how the Head Start program supports them and their needs.
Yeah, so for us being a tribal program, it's not only that they lose the investment of their early childhood education. As a Head Start program, it's a critical investment with health, strength, language, culture. We work together to help the children learn the language and have a safe place for them to come on a daily basis, and we help support the parents by having our center open from 7:30 to 5 so the families can go to work. And with the funding cuts, we wouldn't be able to support them in being able to kind of have those high quality cultural responsive services for our children all the way from birth to 5, because we do have a home-based program that also supports prenatal moms.
Andrea, there are some people that are critical of Head Start, and they might be listening to the show right now, and they would say, well, that's rough that there might not be money to run a Head Start program, but what if you folks were just to go ahead and just pivot and create another type of early childhood development program like preschool? Is that feasible?
Not necessarily, because Head Start has been supported and has been around for many, many years. And when you look at the overall picture of Head Start, it encompasses the whole family. So you provide services to not only the child, but it encompasses the family, and it's the overall family's mental health. It's of the overall the family's well-being. It also encompasses skills to help the families be successful as they go through their programming with Head Start. We, unlike pre-K and some of those other programs that are out there, we integrate services that are provided to the whole family. So it's not like you could just exchange it for a different program. Head Start is very impactful, and it's not only impactful for the children, but it's the family as a whole, and that's multiple families that have gone through Head Start since way back when. And so it has been a program that is working. It has been there since the early times, and it's going on its 60th year to celebrate. So, and that's not to mention even those programs that are in the rural areas. So there's a lot that it's not just impacting one or two programs. It's millions and millions of children and families.
Is there any out-of-pocket cost for the families who attend Head Start there at Isleta Pueblo?
No, there's no out-of-pocket cost for any of the families.
Andrea, what are you hearing from other people who are running tribal Head Start programs in other parts of the country? Are they voicing similar concerns?
Yeah, and I think, like I said, it's not only the impact here in tribal nations, it's a federal impact across the nation. So it is probably about 800,000 of the nation's most at-risk children that do attend Head Start. And Head Start's mission of serving children who are like the ones at most risk. I know for Native communities, we have the option to serve those that are in our own area without income levels being affected. But when you look at the overall picture as a whole, it's the most vulnerable children that would be losing those services, because they don't have to pay for services and they do have a safe place to go during the day.
All right. Andrea, thank you for joining the conversation. I want to go back to Alicia Allard in Bellingham, Washington. And Alicia, I want to ask you first, your title, Head Start Consultant. What is the role of a Head Start consultant like yourself?
Yeah, so apologies for my phone line earlier. So I am a former parent of two very successful Head Start graduates, and I am a former Head Start director. And I now work with Head Start programs across the country who are working towards their grant requirements and monitoring compliance and program quality assurance and making sure that maybe a lot of these tribal programs who are often operating with a very small crew of management and leaders to be there for an extra set of experienced hands to make sure that they have all the tools they need to be successful, maintain their sustainability, and continually increasing their program quality and maintaining their ability to comply with Head Start grant requirements, which every year get a little more complicated. That's my main role as a consultant.
Let's talk about the major staff cuts at the Department of Health and Human Services, which oversees Head Start programs. What's been the impact that you've seen from that?
Yeah, so right now, and this may change as I'm saying this sentence, so 5 of the 10 regional offices have been closed, including my local Region 10 office, and it's a huge impact. They're spread out across the country, so every area has one team who kind of knows their area, and then the tribal AIAN region is managed out of the Washington, D.C. office. And they have a really dedicated, knowledgeable team who specializes in working with the tribal communities. And they're also kind of dwindling down to, a point where they're really struggling to maintain their ability to support all of the grantees right now. And so basically at this point, the support team at the federal level has been cut in half. And our local region, we have 70 plus grant recipients who have a grant renewal coming up in July. And they're depending on getting those grants processed, the grant renewals processed and reviewed and approved by the deadline. And if that doesn't happen, there's no more program. And so, not having a local office full of the team who, these grants, the directors of anybody who's managed a federally funded program knows a federal grant is, it's not an easy process. You don't submit it in one day. It's a, months long process usually. And so having the team that you submit that to gone and not knowing who's even your contact anymore, this on its face is creating a lot of confusion, slowing down the gears of the process. And so that right now is kind of the status, and who knows what's coming next.
Alicia, Head Start was founded in 1965. President Lyndon Johnson. It was part of his War on Poverty initiative. It is a program designed for underserved communities, often low-income families. We're going back almost, 60 years. Is the data there to show that Head Start has been a real benefit in tribal communities? Because, again, there are a lot of people questioning right now whether or not it's worth spending taxpayer dollars on programs like Head Start.
Yeah, there's been a really concerted effort, I think, from people that, first off, what I've seen is kind of a lot of people pushing a false narrative that Head Start and education in general is being directed from the federal level and dictated down to the communities of what needs to be taught and implemented. And Tribal Head Start is, there's always room for improvement. Tribes have, they are, I'm going to make sure I'm phrasing this right. So they receive the grant funding. Tribes have the ability to apply and be the grantees. And then they design and implement the program as is fit for their community. Same as any community level, so a Head Start that would be operated by a community action program or a nonprofit. At the tribal level, there's a lot of allowances in the Head Start performance standards that provide additional provisos for tribes to integrate and implement tribal language, so full language immersion programs, indigenous foods, and so tribes have a lot of leeway to really make the Head Start program something that fits their communities and that is designed by their communities. And in the last year, there was additional advocacy that successfully allowed tribes to create and implement their own curriculum. And so there's now even more abilities for tribes to really create these programs, these early learning programs that fit their own communities, their cultures, their traditions, and reflect what they want the children that are going to be leading their communities in the future to be learning and to carrying on with them into their the rest of their lives. And so while, like I said, there's always room for improvement, that has been really built into the program for quite a while and continues to be advocated for.
Alicia, thank you so much for joining the conversation. Unfortunately, we're out of time. We're going to have to wrap up, but I want to thank all of the guests on the show today. Cassandra Osterlo, Andrea Piscina, Jill Falcon Raymaker, April Counselor, and Alicia Allard for joining the conversation. Join us tomorrow for a discussion about the troubling decline of honeybees and other pollinators. Hope you'll tune in. I'm Sean Spruce.
Program support by AmeriCorps Vista, where you can kickstart your career and help others in your community. With AmeriCorps Vista, you can serve in an office setting and address issues of poverty while gaining career experience and building your leadership skills. Learn more by visiting AmeriCorps.gov/Vista today. That's AmeriCorps.gov/VISTA.
Support provided by Amerind. Amerind is 100% tribally owned and partners with tribes and their businesses to provide affordable commercial insurance coverage, protect tribal sovereignty, and strengthen Native American communities by helping to keep dollars in Indian country. Information about property, liability, commercial auto, and workers' comp available at Amerind.com. That's AmeriND.com.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet. Ain't no hope.
This pretty thing, listen here. I wanna hum something pretty, something lovers sing, sentimental ditty to a sweet pretty thing. I wanna hum any summer, any fall or spring. There really isn't any season for a sweet pretty thing. on ditties that simple will win her for me. It's got to be simple, no deluxe, no delish, no delovely, no. I wanna hum something pretty, something lovers sing.